listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
This is Football in Europe. I'm your host, Rob Daly, your weekly European football podcast. Chris Parrott is away this week, but we've got loads of great guests coming up. The Bundesliga's back. I was at Freiburg Bayern on Friday with Archie Rintutt, who is going to be joining us later on, a BT Sport set pieces journalist. We're going to be speaking to Owen O'Callaghan, Irish football journalist who's just done a film where he's taken a Hollywood star to see Celtic, the club he supported his whole career. So that's a great chat as well. We're going to be talking very briefly about things in Spain because Real Madrid got back to winning ways in unconvincing style. And Neymar is back on the score sheet, having scored his first goal from open play since the 4-0 win over Manchester City for Barcelona. It hasn't really been flying for him. But we're going to start this week's show with Italian football, and I'm delighted to say we're joined by a Football in Europe favourite in BT Sport commentator Adam Summerton. Adam, thank you as always for joining us on the show.
No worries, Rob. Good to speak to you again.
Yeah, great. You've had a good weekend. You saw a little bit of Roma on Sunday night. You were commentating on them for BT.
Yeah, I mean, it was a game that I probably expected Roma to win reasonably convincingly because Cagliari have only taken 4 points on the road this season. Roma had won every single home league game, but it was a little bit more difficult than I think they'd maybe anticipated at the Olimpico. They got the job done, though, in the end. Just one goal in it, Dzeko with it 10 minutes into the second half, and they roll on, Roma, in terms of the title challenge, 1 point behind Juve again, although the champions have played a game less. But there was a bit of history, I suppose, as well for Roma in that game, in that they equaled a very long-standing club record. That was their 13th consecutive home league win in a row, equaling that club record that stood since November 1930. So a really nice little piece of club history there.
Juve have been on a similar run of home form, haven't they? Didn't they win a load of games in a row and set their own, or maybe even a Serie A record or something?
Yeah, they have set the record of the most consecutive home wins, and they won again at the weekend, beating Lazio by 2-0 in Turin. They started the game fantastically well, certainly the better team. There was a good energy, a good tempo about the play, and really intriguingly, Rob, for Juve, Allegri decided to go with a 4-2-3-1 formation, which, you know, really attacking, with Mandzukic and Higuain and Dybala all in the same side, Cuadrado in the midfield as well. So a lot of people were surprised by the formation, for one, and intrigued to see how it worked. And, you know, against a Lazio side, who are a very capable team, I mean, they've done it very well this season. Simone Inzaghi's done a great job to get them in the hunt for the Champions League places in their fourth. So it was a test for Juve, particularly after losing the week before as well against Fiorentina, and they bounce back really well. You expect that from Juve. They are a club that do, you know, if once they're wounded, they almost always bounce back, don't they? And it was a good performance from them, a very, very much a well-deserved victory. I'm intrigued to see whether the formation carries on going forward, though, or whether that was just for that particular game. And he has tinkered with the formations this season. We've seen various different ones from Allegri. It's great that it shows a versatility. I just wonder, you know, would he play that formation, for example, in the Champions League? I'm not quite so sure. It's going to be really interesting to see what they do in respect to formation once they get to in the knockout stages of the Champions League.
It wasn't just an interesting formation, or it was almost a very attacking player selection from Allegri in that game. Dybala and Higuain with the goals. Higuain, the first Juve player to score 5 league games in a row since Trezeguet back in 2005. We're going to get onto the Juventus badge in a minute, Adam, because I know it's something everyone's been talking about. But, you know, we were talking about their impressive home form and Roma's home form. You sense there's an issue with Juve on the road because they haven't been as successful in away games so far this season. What, beaten by Fiorentina the weekend before? What's the logic, do you think, to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to put your finger on what the problem is. I can only go by what Allegri has been saying, in that he's concerned that they're not controlling games well enough, particularly away from home. And I think that he was talking about how they like to obviously have the majority of the possession, but he said possession doesn't necessarily equal control. And that's the word he keeps using, control. And I think we have seen a dip in that from Juve, particularly away from home. I mean, not too long ago, they got beaten by Genoa, you might remember. They lost just recently recently against Fiorentina. They deserved to lose that game as well. Fiorentina were the better team. So, yeah, no problems at all for Juventus at home. They're almost untouchable, really, on their own patch in Serie A. But away from home, I think there are one or two issues that they need to sort out there. I think, you know, they have had injury problems that maybe we don't talk about quite so much as we should do with Juve because of the incredible squad that they have, the strength and depth that they have. You know, there's always another international footballer ready to step in when another one's injured. So I don't think that's maybe been given as many column inches or as enough sort of credit, if you like, that maybe that's been perhaps a little part of the problems. But I do think that there are one or two issues, particularly away from home, for them to iron out going forward and maybe settling on a formation. Maybe that's a strength as well, that they are fairly fluid in that respect. They can change formations. But there's no doubt that for me, watching them of late, there has been a difference between the home and away performances.
So let's talk about the new Juve badge, Adam. It was unveiled at a fancy event in Milan at the Science and Technology Museum in Milan last week with the DJ and cocktails. And it provoked quite the reaction because it's an iconic badge that they've just switched to almost like a J with another bit on it. I'm sure people have seen it. First of all, what do you make to the badge itself before we get into the argument about the changing badges and all that?
I'm quite open-minded with this, I've got to say.
Do you care that much, or are you not?
I suppose I do care in that, I suppose in a way I'm a little bit of a traditionalist. I like the history of football, but in the same breath, I do understand the need to modernise and move forward. And so I'm kind of really in two minds about this. I haven't got a firm opinion either way. I don't necessarily agree with those that are horrified by it. But I do understand supporters who say, you know, let's stick with tradition, let's keep it. And change is always difficult in all aspects of life, isn't it? So, you know, these things are always going to take some time to get used to. But I think that Juve very often are ahead of the curve as a club, a little bit like the way Bayern are in Germany. I've always admired that about Bayern. They're a club who are exceptionally well run off the pitch and look to try and get ahead of the opposition. I mean, you only have to look at Juve owning their own stadium and the huge benefits and how far ahead they could potentially be of the opposition for a long time in Italy, in a big part because of that stadium. And maybe this is, in a way, an extension of that. It's about them looking ahead, changing before they have to, was, I think, one of the quotes that was said at the press conference. And, you know, it's interesting that I've had a look online and tried to sort of find different opinions, not just those of football supporters. And I was intrigued to see one or two people involved in marketing saying and branding saying that they actually thought that the whole package that Juve have put together in terms of this new branding is exceptional, was one of the words that I saw used. So, you know, I think you have to take in a variety of opinions, don't you, and accept the fact that change is difficult.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I mean, Juve have been very forward-thinking. I've been to the Juventus Stadium, and it's unlike any other stadium, essentially, in Italy. I mean, it's in some levels, it's basic. There's it's still concrete concourses. It's not like, you know, something like Wembley, where it's, you know, it can feel very fancy at points. But I was looking, their revenues have grown by 125% over the last 5 years. And the club have said, I mean, Andrea Agnelli, president, obviously a part of that long-running family associated with Juventus, has talked about China and the US and having to ask themselves what a little girl in Shanghai and the millennial in Mexico City would be thinking. I saw that in a James Horncastle piece. I mean, it all ties in to their dominance, doesn't it? Winning five titles in a row.
Well, they're getting something right, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I think that, I suppose, if you're an Italian born in Turin and you follow Juve, you can understand someone saying, well, why do we care what a little girl in China thinks? This is the example that you've just used there. But I think that big Cubs these days, they have to care what a little girl in China thinks, or, you know, what a little boy in,
yeah,
I don't know, in Indonesia thinks.
Or whatever, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I think they have to think, because the game is different now. It's more globalized. I mean, you only have to look at in the UK in terms of what we can watch on our televisions these days, in terms of, you know, when we were five or six, you know, there was only really the Italian football on Channel 4 that you could watch in terms of something different to UK football. So the game is changing in that respect, and I think you need to embrace that. But this J is obviously the significant part, you know, because it's not just with the logo that they're using this. Obviously, they want it known as the J Stadium. There's the J Medical Centre, that where all the players are getting treated. And in being constructed at the moment, as I understand it, is the J Village, where it's going to be the training ground. So everything's around this J and marketing the club around this. But I've got to tell you, Rob, there was quite a funny thing about this the whole J and the logo. The former Inter player now at Roma, Juan Jesus, has his own logo branded. Obviously, Juan Jesus, a double J. And he went on social media after the Juve logo was released and say, hang on a minute, obviously tongue-in-cheek, hang on a minute, you've stolen my logo, which was quite funny. Obviously, with him being a former Inter player as well, there's no love lost with Juve either.
Well, if he wants to take on their legal powers, God bless him. But I think he might lose that battle. Elsewhere, Adam, there was a defeat for Milan. They lost 2-1 to Napoli at home, with Insigne and Cajon putting Napoli ahead inside 9 minutes. Kutzka pulled one back, but it was a great win for Napoli. And Milan are looking to do some business in the transfer window, because as things stand, and certainly from what I saw last night, it looks like Deulofeu is going there on loan. Can you understand the logic behind that?
If you'd asked me that about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I would have said no. But having thought about it now, I've been reading a lot of comments that Montella's been making about Niang. And I get the feeling that he's not very impressed right now for various reasons. Niang had become a really important player for Milan. And I've always said, I think I might have said it on this podcast, that had he not been involved in that car accident that ended his season when Mihailovic was still in charge, I wonder whether Mihailovic would even have lost his job, because I think he'd become that important to the team. And when he got injured at that stage of last season, I think they lost a bit of their rhythm, Milan, and obviously Mihailovic ended up going. But this season, I think he'd started the campaign pretty well, but I think that Montella's concerned about consistency with Niang, and he has been quite critical of him, and there's even been talk that Niang could be moved on to the Premier League. So whether Deulofeu is going to be a replacement or an alternative to Niang, that could be, I mean, because it can't be for Suso, because you'd expect Deulofeu ordinarily to be on the right. But Suso has been very good this season for Milan. He's been one of the best players. So I'd be surprised if he's looking to bring somebody in to take the place of Suso. So it might be that he sees Deulofeu's position as being on the left. So that's the only logical conclusion that I can come to, unless he just wants a bit more competition for Suso on the right.
I mean, Deulofeu, I saw a lot of Everton last year, and Deulofeu's position, best position, is definitely on the right-hand side. Yeah. Because he has this bizarre crossing technique where the ball can really dip down viciously. I'm surprised Ronald Koeman isn't interested in using him. But what was interesting was that last Friday, AC Milan tweeted to say they'd signed him on loan, and they hadn't, and they had to delete the tweet. And really quite embarrassing, in truth, for the Rossoneri, as they look to complete that deal. Adam, can I ask you about Inter as well? Because we talked a lot, and I think we talked yourself as well, about the disaster that was the De Boer era at the start of the Inter campaign. I don't think it was necessarily his fault, but they got a 1-0 win at Palermo at the weekend, a side who were flirting with the idea of sacking their third coach of the season, constantly in chaos. But Inter are making tracks. João Mario with the winner at Palermo. Have you seen a change with the Nerazzurri under their recently appointed head coach, Stefano Pioli?
Yeah, I think that the first thing to say on that is that you can tell the difference between a group of players who are buying into what the coach is trying to do and a group of players who, for the most part, clearly weren't, for whatever reason, under De Boer. I felt very sorry for him, actually, particularly as you just alluded to there. He came in at quite short notice in terms of the start of the season, difficult circumstances, maybe, you know, was trying to change the style, and they just didn't buy into it, was the impression that I got from the outside. But Pioli has done a very, very good job so far. I'd argue he's way ahead of schedule in terms of what he picked up. 12 games he's been in charge, 9 wins, 1 draw and 2 losses. The only league loss was against Napoli, which we all know is very difficult opposition. 8 wins in a row. So, yeah, I mean, they're right up there. They were above Milan as well, now that they're fifth In the table, I think I'm right in saying off the top of my head. So they're right in the hunt for the Champions League places, which is what their target was at the start of this season. They want to desperately get back involved in the Champions League. There is money there as well going forward. I could envisage them being, along with Juve, the biggest spenders in Italy going forward. They have been already. So I think it's exciting times potentially at Inter, even though when he was appointed, Rob, it was seen as a pretty underwhelming appointment. Some even said it might even be a stopgap appointment, bringing in Pioli, but he's done very well indeed.
Yeah, exciting to see what Inter do for the remainder of the season. I'll just do a couple of headlines from France here. Memphis Depay made his debut for Lyon after completing his move to the club from Manchester United. £16 million rising to 21.7. He came on as a sub as Lyon beat their fierce rivals Marseille 3-1. Lacazette with a couple of goals in that game. Edinson Cavani scored twice in a 2-0 win over Nantes. He's now on 20 league goals for the season. It's his best ever at Paris Saint-Germain. Julian Draxler did come off injured in that game ahead of League Cup action in the week in France. Did you see Verratti's yellow card, by the way, Adam?
I haven't seen it, but I've heard you describe it.
Glorious. And it just sounds like, yeah. He had the ball near his own penalty area, got down on essentially on his hands and knees, and headed the ball back to Kevin Trapp. The referee gave him a yellow card for unsporting conduct, which I thought was absolutely absolutely cheap.
I can imagine his face when he got the yellow card as well.
It's priceless.
His face, I can imagine that. Yeah.
I'll put that on our Twitter feed as well. Also, there was an incident with Mario Balotelli, now at Nice, racially abused by Bastia fans at the weekend in a 1-1 draw. Balotelli posting about it on Instagram, and it looks like the club will be in trouble. Be in Sports and broadcast some of the abuse that was directed at Balotelli as well, and you can clearly pick out people abusing him, especially during the warm-up. I don't want to ask you about the specific incident, Adam, but it's not the first time that Balotelli's encountered this, and I think back to even his time at Milan. I mean, it's sad to see this kind of thing, isn't it, really?
It is. It's very sad to see, and I think that the book could well be thrown at Bastia, because it's not just the footage that's been shown of the supporters, which is quite clear and evident what's happening there, but also there was some tunnel cam footage as well, which doesn't look very good at all for the club either, with one or two things that were said, not necessarily racially abusive language used in the tunnel, but it was very aggressive and seemed unnecessary and
towards
what had motivated
Balotelli. Yeah.
Towards Balotelli and what had motivated it, I think people are asking as well. So it's a very bad situation, yeah, for all, isn't it? And you know, I've covered some Bastia games in the past, and I remember one game where they're very close to the pitch, aren't they, at that stadium? And I can remember a game I was doing, if it escapes my mind who it was, but there was like wooden sticks being thrown at the players repeatedly who were taking the corner. So they have had one or two problems in the past with crowd issues there. So, yeah, it's sad. It's unnecessary. And I hope that... I think Balotelli's right to go, you know, to sort of publicly go out there and say this is I can't remember what exactly he said in his social media post, but I think that, you know, he's right to shine a light on it and say that this is unacceptable, because if you don't do that, I don't think then you can force change, can you? Unless, you know,
exactly,
that people are forced to confront the issues that are clearly there.
We think Kevin Prince-Boateng taking the action he did in a game,
yeah,
famously,
absolutely,
while at AC Milan as well. Adam, yeah, great to get you on. Thank you so much as always. And we come on again soon.
I hope so.
Good man. Okay, next up, we're going to be speaking to, this is an interview I did recently with Eoin O'Callaghan, Irish sports journalist currently based in Canada, who's just done a new film called Celtic Soul. Here's a trailer for the film.
This is Football in Europe special interview.
My name is Jay Baruchel.
And I'm Eoin O'Callaghan.
And we are Celtic supporters.
At this moment, all around the world, there are tens of thousands of Celtic supporters dressed in green and white, cheering for the legendary club.
Eoin asked me, have you ever been to see Celtic play? And I said, no. He said, well, maybe we could go see them. And on the way, explore my Irish roots.
That's your map of Canada.
Yours looks like a chicken nugget.
A road trip.
From Montreal to Dublin.
Across the Galway for a hurling game.
Yeah! Up the coast to Westport, where my family comes from.
There was a Walsh, also on Peter Street.
The fact that it got down to an address, it's huge.
I think we passed it, homie. It said destinations on the right. And that was like 5 minutes ago.
Then over to Scotland.
up to Glasgow. It's such a good town. It's the murder capital of Europe, but
you can't be perfect.
Then Lennox Town to watch Celtic train.
I can't quite believe I'm here.
Pressure, and finally, paradise.
You think of how many players have walked through that tunnel and onto that pitch, and you just feel 10 foot tall. You cannot compete with what Celtic has as a club.
Whose idea was this?
Come on, Chuckle!
92!
This is incredible. You talk about history and you talk about the whole journey that we've been on. Ancestry, emigration, 3 countries, and it all boils down to this.
Okay, joining us on the show now is Irish football journalist Eoin O'Callaghan. Eoin, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Eoin, we just heard the trailer for your film, Celtic Soul, and it looks really great. I've not seen it yet, with Jay Baruchel. Where would people know Jay from? Just to give a bit of context, because I've seen him in a few comedies in American films. What films would people know him from?
Jay's had a little bit of an interesting career. You know, for certain people, they might remember him from Million Dollar Baby, where he was directed by Clint Eastwood. But obviously, as you mentioned, it's his kind of comedic roles that I suppose people have more of an affiliation with. So Tropic Thunder, in which he starred alongside Jack Black and Ben Stiller and Robert Downey Jr., Knocked Up. With Seth Rogen and Jason Segel and all those types of guys, and he's been in lots of others. He's the voice of Hiccup in the How to Train Your Dragon series of animated movies as well. So he's had a wide and varied career.
So how did you meet Jay, first of all?
That's a kind of a story in itself. So in a previous life, I was a host of a TV show in North America called Fox Soccer Report. And the show was effectively a nightly hour-long roundup of the day's soccer headlines and main stories and highlights from around the world. And it was produced and everything happened from a studio in Canada, but it was broadcast right across all of North America and into parts of the Caribbean and stuff like that. So if you were a soccer fan and lived in North America, this was really your way of catching up on everything that you would be a fan of. And unbeknownst to me, Jay was a massive fan of the show and he used to watch it all the time. So we had this really bizarre start to a friendship where we kind of followed each other on Twitter, and I kind of sent him a little message, the same kind of message if any remotely famous person kind of follows you on social media. You just say, oh, I'm kind of very humbled, I'm a big fan of yours. And he responded to me by saying, oh, I'm a big fan of yours as well, buddy. And that kind of was a bit weird. And we just kind of went from there, really. It was a back and forth about... I knew that he was a Celtic fan, but he, along with being a big Celtic fan, he's just a massive sports fan generally. So obviously he's a Montreal kid, and ice hockey is a huge obsession in his life, particularly the Montreal Canadiens, which is his local team. And we just started talking really about sport, and I was interested in why a kid in Canada grows up with such an affiliation for a Scottish team. In Glasgow, and he started to talk to me about his Irish ancestry, and it was, you know, slowly but surely, I kind of knew that there were the ingredients of something to explore, and essentially we texted and emailed, and all of those texts and all of the content of those messages that we swapped essentially kind of formed the content of this film. It was very, very similar in terms of the stories that we wanted to touch on and the kind of layers that we wanted to peel away.
So basically, as we heard, I mean, the trailer effectively explains it, but it seems like it's a road trip between you two exploring not just Ireland and his roots, but obviously going up to to Celtic. How excited did he seem to you to at last get to Glasgow and see a game there?
Oh, it was crazy because he's a massive fan of Idlewild, the band, and he had actually been in Glasgow shooting a music video for one of their singles, I think maybe in 2015 or 2014. And the guys that he was around were asking him, oh, do you want to hang out? We want to go to a Celtic game. So he felt so bad. He was like, oh, you know, I'm doing this project with my buddy. So I, you know, it's part of a documentary. I just don't want to spoil it. So he had the opportunity already to go to Celtic Park and he turned it down when he was in the city. So he was just, it was like watching a kid on Christmas morning, really. You know, it was because ultimately, you know, what the film is, it's a journey. So, you know, that the final destination is this kind of experience that he's always wanted. And there's the anticipation. It's like going to bed on Christmas Eve. You know, it's you kind of have a feeling of what's to come the following morning, but you're still not quite sure. So, you know, those days that precedes us getting to Glasgow, you know, it's obviously us in Ireland and, you know, it's us traveling from the East Coast to the West Coast and tracing his ancestry and lineage. And you can kind of feel him getting a little bit more excitable. And, you know, once we get the boat from Belfast to the west coast of Scotland and begin the drive to Glasgow, it's just it's kind of the final arc of the story. And it's that kind of the final segment, really. And it kind of everything just gets upped a little bit, the anticipation and the energy levels. And I mean, he was. You know, he's a proper fan. I mean, you kind of, you know, sometimes when you're in the industry that we're in, you meet guys who talk the talk, you know, and they claim many things and you know, you're kind of easily found out. But as I said originally, he is obsessed with sport. And I mean, we don't talk whenever we get together. We don't talk about movies. It's always he's asking me about Montreal Impact and how I thought the MLS season's gone and the plans for a Canadian domestic league and why it's a good thing. And actually, let me show you some figures. And off he goes. He's just a really big, obsessive sports guy. So his history in terms of Celtic and the players that he knows and how far he can go back, it's great. And it's always fantastic to be in the company of someone who's passionate about something. So, it was a real joy, really, from start to finish.
Now, Owen, I've known you probably about 2 or 3 years, and we don't see each other that regularly. But this never got mentioned, and I was in Air Sport where we worked together previously, and I said, "Did anyone know about this?" And no one did. So, did you just keep this under your hat for years that you were working on this?
Well, there's a few kind of reasons for it. Like, I mean, firstly, these things are so temperamental, and you know. The first idea that I had for this was in late 2012, early 2013. But at that stage, I'm in my kitchen in Dublin, you know, piecing together something on a laptop, never believing in a million years that it was likely to happen in the way that it did. You know, you obviously have to be very confident in that, you know, you can get a story up and running. But there are so many issues that crop up. And, we had issues throughout this. I mean, how does a guy in Dublin make a 90-minute film, sports film, with a production company in Toronto starring a Hollywood actor? I mean, like, you know, where do you, even if you wanted to begin, like, where do you go from there? So the reason I kind of kept it under my hat was, firstly, you don't want to be the guy who comes into an office one day and talks about this mad thing and cool thing that he's up to with his special friend.
And then it falls through.
And then it falls through because you look like an idiot. So I was very, very conscious up to the very last moment that, you know, the people who knew about it were family, even very close friends, you know, were told a little bit about it, but what was great about when we finally got it up and running was that the people around you, like family members and very close friends, you finally had something to show them, because you hate to be the guy who talks about this big project and then it doesn't come to fruition. So, and bit by bit, I mean, we filmed all the stuff in Montreal in February of 2015. So that was a weekend. I flew to Montreal. We kind of hung out for a weekend and we shot all essentially what is the opening 10, 15 minutes of the movie. And that was just all encompassed in one weekend. And when I got back from that trip, I had stuff to show people. You know, I had some content and we were kind of up and running and we had got a little bit of money in order to start the cameras rolling. And then because of logistics and because of scheduling, we didn't make the rest of it for 12 months. So, you start off in February 2015 thinking, oh, this is fantastic. You know, the rest of the year is going to be amazing. And I left Jay in Montreal in, you know, after doing that piece of filming. And I didn't see him until we met each other in Dublin 12 months later. And he came straight from the airport and we filmed the sequence in Croke Park where Jay tries hurling for the first time. and, you know, he was jet lagged, but he just came right from this transatlantic flight and just wanted to hit the ground running. And we hadn't seen each other. Obviously, we had talked and we'd been in touch, but just because of the nature of what this was, I mean, it was so ambitious and it was difficult. You know, logistics were difficult. Jay's an immensely busy guy. You know, he has a comedy show here in the States on FX, the channel called Man Seeking Woman. It takes up a lot of his time. He's a central character, so he's basically in every scene. So it was. It was a logistical nightmare. So apologies for not revealing bit by bit what we were going through.
No.
But hopefully, you know, you can kind of understand to a certain degree that these projects can be here today and gone tomorrow. And it's just best if you kind of keep it on the down low and just see how it plays out rather than kind of making a big announcement and then, you know, 12 months sure. down the line.
I'm really excited to see the film. Some of the shots of Ireland, I mean, it looks like it's shot brilliantly. People will be wondering because we'll post the trailer as well on our Twitter account and the film's been in a few festivals so far. When do you think people will be able to see this, you know, maybe through a streaming service or something like that, or are you just concentrated on getting it into festivals and stuff at the moment?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a, you know, the industry is, you know, it's kind of baby steps. And I suppose I've never been in a band and never released an album. So this is a ridiculous comparison to make, but I'm sure it's a little bit like releasing an album where, a record label wants to exhaust every various means that are available to them. So, you know, before you go on tour, you know, you release your three singles or four singles. So you want to maximize every particular strand. So for us at the moment, the strand we're focusing on is North America. And obviously, it spent a week in a theater, in a cinema here in Toronto, which was amazing. We had a kind of an official premiere. There are various festivals that it's already appeared at. There is a UK festival that I can reveal that the film will be showing at very soon. But what I can say is that, you know, we visit the particular city in the documentary. So I'm really, really psyched about that as a thing that's cropping up and getting some people in the UK to get a chance to come along and see it. Yes, there are definite plans to make it available online. So many people consume films and various things via streaming services. So that is definitely in the future plans. It's obviously in the future plans to have it available on more terrestrial means, so on your TV screens if we can. But at the moment, North America is the market that we just kind of want to nail down in terms of all of those different ways of getting people to see it. So we have a Twitter account, Celtic Soul Movie. So hopefully people can follow all of the updates via that. And also as well, if people are kind of down with this and it's something that they think they'd be interested in, we have an amazing website. It's CelticSoul.ca. We had so much footage and we filmed so many great sequences that just didn't make the final edit in various locations in Montreal, various places around Ireland and in Scotland as well. And they just give somebody a nice taste of what to expect in terms of the mood and in terms of the tone. So there are lots of deleted scenes and bonus content available on the website. So if people are that way inclined, it's a nice little place to go and kind of get to experience the film maybe before actually seeing it.
Owen, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and best of luck with the film.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it. Nice one.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
And a big thanks to Owen O'Callaghan for joining us on the podcast. It was great to speak to him a little bit earlier on last week. Some headlines from Spain, by the way. Sevilla continue their title push after a 4-3 win at Osasuna. A thrilling game. They've never had 42 points at the halfway stage in a Liga season before. Sampaoli says he's delighted to have made that record. Valencia have won two in a row since Voro was appointed head coach with a win at Villarreal. Barcelona won 4-0 at Eibar on Sunday night. To keep the pressure on Real Madrid, who after two defeats, one in the league, one in the cup, beat Malaga by 2-1. Sergio Ramos with both goals, as Real Madrid at times were booed during that game. Ramos is now on 8 league goals this season. They're second top scorer, I think. 6 league goals, perhaps, and 8 goals in all competitions, although Marcelo and Modric have picked up fresh injuries. Let's talk about the Bundesliga now, because on the line is BT Sports Set Pieces and Guardian Sports Network journalist Archie Rinter. Archie, hello.
Hi there, Rob. Thanks for the grand introduction, as ever.
No problem at all, Archie. So the Bundesliga's back, and we were both in a very cold Freiburg on the edge of the Black Forest for Freiburg Bayern on Friday night.
Very cold does not do justice to the -9 temperatures that we both had to experience. Well, actually, I think we should kind of deconstruct this for the listeners. One of us had to experience this a lot more than the other. Some people who get to go and commentate for the Bundesliga get to sit in a nice warm box at the back of the stand, whereas others of us have to put on a third pair of socks during the first half, because the other two, along with the two pair of thermals that they've got on, just aren't doing the job for them. So let's just say it was colder for some of us than others, eh? No, I could barely concentrate on the game. It was bizarre. We could talk about the football as well. It was actually a quite enthralling game, because Freiburg really came at Bayern, and I think deservedly led early on. Some of their passing combinations were superb. And of course, when Bayern Munich come to town, you are going to sit a little bit deeper and try and hit them on the counter. And when you do hit them on the counter, you're going to have that little bit more space. Bayern Munich don't have the luxury of being able to pick off their opponents usually until they're a goal up. But I think it was a real test of their character. And I think that the one person who really stood out, obviously, was Robert Lewandowski, not only for his equaliser and the fact that he did score both goals. But that second goal really was from... It was barely half a chance that he scored it from. And Freiburg had been on top in the final 10 minutes. So to produce a finish in injury time where he controls the ball in his chest and then touches it down on his left and then strikes it with his right, all in one movement, was... It's one of the best goals I've ever seen live. Given the conditions, the moment, and indeed the circumstances for Bayern, how badly that win they needed. No, it sounds like I'm trying to translate German to English directly. How really important that win was for them.
Yeah, it certainly was. Perhaps a case of Bayern-Dusel, an expression used when Bayern generally win games late on. They've won all 7 games since Uli Hoeneß returned as president as well. Bizarrely, it was cruel on Freiburg because I thought the intensity that they showed in the first 25 minutes taking on the champions was absolutely staggering.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that it's just another kind of line in the sand, really, of the work from Christian Streich. I don't know whether line in the sand is the correct analogy, but let's go with it. I think that he really has done spectacularly well there since moving up to the top job in 2012. And you see the way that they've played this season. But the fact that they are in 8th spot and they were promoted, obviously the fact that Leipzig have done so well this season has kind of overshadowed that. Plus, behind that, you've had the likes of Eintracht Frankfurt, Hertha, Cologne, Hoffenheim, all doing well, all performing above expectations. So Freiburg's performances this season has somewhat been left in the shadows, but I really admire the way that it's not just been against Bayern, but against every single team they played against this season. Not once have they gone, right, we're going to settle for a draw, which on some occasions has probably not helped them. For example, away at Borussia Dortmund earlier in the season, I remember being amazed at how kind of gung-ho they seemed to be. And on another night, they could have actually won that game. So I think that strategy, particularly after the way that they were relegated two seasons ago, when they conceded on six occasions a late equaliser, so in the 88th minute or after. And I think after that experience, I think that it really kind of set in the minds of some of the players and indeed the coaching staff that they kind of have to have a mentality about the way they approach this Bundesliga season and, well, indeed the way that they were promoted last season. I think that actually that little bit more mentality that I'm speaking to the club captain on the Thursday, Julian Schuster, he said that their relegation was not down to bad concentration, but down to just lacking that little bit of mentality that he says they now have.
Watching Bayern in the flesh was interesting, Archie, because they are top. They're top by 3 points, but again, it looked like a stodgy... It's the kind of game you win if you're going to be champions, I suppose. But it looked like a slow, stodgy game that... Mm-hmm. I mean, they really needed Lewandowski to bail them out of trouble.
You say you were watching Bayern in the flesh, Rob, but I'm pretty sure that you were watching it from behind a glass screen. But that's another point.
Still counts.
Yes. I'm still not bitter about the fact you got to watch it in warmer conditions. No, it was very much a stodgy performance. I think that's the correct word. I think we've also got to bear in mind the context that we're watching this Bayern Munich side in, which is the standards that Pep Guardiola set in his three seasons, where they were pretty much wiping the floor with most teams, and they didn't have a title rival who were breathing down their necks just 3 points behind them. So, that, bearing that in mind, and the fact that there has been a change in style as well from Bayern, I think that there needs to be a little bit, perhaps, of patience for a crossover. But the problem is, at Bayern Munich, you don't get that kind of patience for transition, quite understandably, given the amount of money that is there and how much their budget is than anyone else's in the division. And I would say I'm disappointed with Bayern this season. I've expected more from them. But I think Friday night was something quite different. I think I was talking to Marc Torrejon, the Freiburg centre back after the game, who was saying it was indeed the coldest game he'd ever played in his career. And whilst kind of we do joke about that, even on a player's side, those were weird conditions to play in. And there was still something to be read into. As you say, the fact that Bayern still emerged with a win from those circumstances says a lot about the character of that team. And I think that the character of that team carries them to trophies as much as their actual quality does.
Okay, before we talk about RB Leipzig, I'm just going to run through some headlines from the Bundesliga this weekend. Borussia Dortmund got a 2-1 win at Werder Bremen. Jaroslav Drobny, the goalkeeper, sent off in that game for Bremen. Fish check with what was the eventual winner. Bayer Leverkusen beat Hertha 3-1. Two goals for Hakan Çalhanoğlu. Paul-Georges Ntep, the new signing for Wolfsburg, set up Mario Gomez for the winner in their weekend fixture. And Hoffenheim are now unbeaten in 17 this season after a 2-0 win at Augsburg. Julian Nagelsmann says Rudi and Süle heading to Bayern. They will be joining Bayern in the summer. Two of their best players is not going to be a factor, and those two players will continue to fight for the club. Another story, the Bundesliga is going to become the first major league competition to use video assistant referees from next season. Referees in the Bundesliga have been going through training for this, so it's going to come in very, very soon indeed. They're on the third stage of testing with referees as well. And the video assistant referees are actually going to be based in a central location. And the feeds of the matches are going to be fed into them. They're not going to be at the game. And then they're going to make a decision and send that back to the referee. So we'll keep an eye on that over the coming weeks as well, because that's very interesting from the Bundesliga. Always quite progressive. Finally, Archie, RB Leipzig stay within 3 points of Bayern after a 3-0 win over Eintracht Frankfurt. But it was a game that was rather bizarre, in truth, in the manner of the win.
That's one way of putting it. 131 seconds in, Leipzig play a ball forward, a ball that you would expect your goalkeeper to come out and get. Now, Lukasz Radecki was very much on his way to coming out to get the ball. However, he slipped. And then he had a decision to make, because the ball was within his grasp and there was a likely forward there in front of him. We're talking about 20 yards from his goal. That's about 5 yards further out from his box. So the decision in front of him was this. Do you leave the ball and risk the Leipzig striker taking the ball and putting it in the net? Or do you grab the ball and risk getting sent off and leaving your side with 10 men for 87 minutes and picking up a three-match ban yourself, given how well you've been playing this season? Probably not the wisest thing to do. He chose option B there, got sent off. It was one of the most bizarre sending offs I've ever seen. It was also the quickest ever sending off of a goalkeeper in Bundesliga history, which is a record that I'm sure won't really console Lukasz Radecki. But the weirdest thing about this, Rob, is that Radecki was asked after the game, kind of, your decision, kind of, why did you do it? And he ended up saying that, yeah, you know, it happened, but in the same situation, again, I would make the same decision, which must just have Niko Kovac tearing his hair out, because there is no way that he can analyze that, even after kind of 80 minutes of contemplation in the dugout, and think, I made the right choice. Because, I mean, Frankfurt are one of the best prepared teams, I would say, in the division, one of the most well-disciplined. And I think that it probably said it really pushed to the boundaries of the extent that how many situations does Niko Kovac have a plan for everything. It turns out that he doesn't have a plan for his goalkeeper getting sent off after 2 minutes and the rest of his team having to play with 10 men. To be honest, I don't blame him for that. Frankfurt have been really, really quite good this season. But yeah, they got completely by one terrible decision by the goalkeeper.
Well, it's probably good for the title race. Leipzig stay within 3 points of Bayern. It's great to have the Bundesliga back, and great to have you back on the podcast, Archie. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. Cheers.
Okay, that's all for football in Europe. We're going to be discussing Messi's contract situation, something we brought up last week in further depth, next week when Chris is back. If you want to tweet us, it's at FIE Podcast. And if you do like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. We're going to be back next Monday.
This is Football in Europe.